Hey everyone, you can now hear How Did I Get Here while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode of How Did I Get Here is always available to you. No syncing needed, and no memory or storage wasted. Available for your iPhone, Android phones, webOS phones, or your BlackBerry. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
That's right. I am Johnny Gowdy. I'm your host. This is How Did I Get Here? That was Corey Glazer's song, Needle Hits the Groove, just playing on there. I always like to give him a shout out. He has a connection to today's guest for episode 30, but we'll get to that in a minute. It's Wednesday, December 14th, 2011. I would like to wish my cousin Emily a very happy birthday. She's 30 today. This is episode 30, so it's like this culmination of magic exploding into my face like a cream pie. So anyway, Wednesday, December 14th, tonight my band Liars and Saints will be playing at Hotel Vegas. If you're here in Austin, come on out. It's on the east side, look it up. And happy birthday, Emily. I'd like to give a plug to my friend Shane Matt put together this holiday ham jam album, which features Austin musicians playing playing Christmas songs, 16 different songs. It's like $10, I think, the album. You can find it at www.myhaam.org, myham.org, which is the Health Alliance for Austin Area Musicians. So this album benefits the Health Alliance, and it features people like Shelley King, Wendy Colonna, Vallejo, John D. Graham, Dan Dyer, David Garza, a lot of different people. Looks really good. 16 different songs, a lot of Christmas music there. And you can find that at myham.org. And so also, they're putting together a holiday ham jam benefit concert at Antone's, which is this Monday, December 19th, from 7:30 to midnight. And it'll feature Austin area musicians jamming with the Ham Jam All-Star Band, which I guess I'm doing it. I'm playing at 7:30. I start it. I picked out my songs already. They're not super, they're not like, you know, a Frosty the Snowman or anything like that. Let me just put it that way. And I also brought Big JC back into everything. Not that I'm super religious, but I like this song by Big Star, if that's a hint as to what I'm playing. But anyway, it goes from 7:30 to midnight. Charlie Faye and Will Sexton, Warren Hood, Dave Madden, Wendy Colonna, Laura Scarborough, Shelley King, a lot of different people. Tickets are $10. I think it's $150 for the VIP seating, which I guess is up at the thing. Anyways, for all ages, go to antones.net or myham.org to find out about this. And come on out. It's a great thing to support. Shane's a good guy, and he does a lot of work with the Ham. My guest for episode 30 is an old friend of mine from Fastball, Tony Scalzo. I will preface this interview. Tony's a great guy, and I've been talking to him for a long time about getting on here. I'm really glad he was able to come over. I thought he had finished his record, but he hasn't finished it yet. But we had a really good conversation last night. I really like him. I always have. Before we go into this interview, I'm gonna lay an anecdote on you. One time I talked to him, and we got together to write a song, and he asked me if I could come over. I was like, hey, what time do you want me to come over to your house? And he was like, oh, okay, well, come over at 8 a.m. And so I went, and not many people do that. So I went there and at 8 a.m. to write a song, and we sat down and we talked, and I don't know, we might have played a little bit. We were gonna go out in his jam, in his little studio, and rock out on some stuff. So before we did that, I went to the bathroom. As I walked down the hallway in a dark corner put away so that people couldn't really see it, as a platinum record for their hit album All the Pain Money Can Buy, And so when I came out of the bathroom, I walked up and I was like, hey, you know, this is so cool because you don't normally go to someone's house in Austin and they have like platinum records on their wall. So you know, to write a song with someone and they're already, you know, kind of written hits. So he goes, oh yeah, it's pretty cool. Not as cool as this though. And he pulls out this platinum bong, which was given to him by High Times for writing like the best song of the year, which was The Way. I was very impressed by a guy that has a platinum record and a platinum bong. It's actually a platinum bong on like a thing and has a little plaque on it that says, you know, this is Scalzo and this is his jam. So this is the song that earned the man a platinum bong. So you had a podcast, right? You and Miles did.
We did.
He didn't really talk about it on the podcast. Tell me about it. What was it? You guys would drink wine with people?
Yeah. It was called the Moderately Priced Winos.
Really?
Yeah, in reference to Keith Richards' band.
Right.
The Expensive Winos.
Right.
Moderately Priced Winos.
Who all did you guys have as guests?
We had a few people. We had some local people, but we also had some pretty big names. We had Mike Mills from REM.
Wow.
And he had the wine. We went over to his suite at the Four Seasons when REM was doing that thing at Stubbs.
Right.
And he had some awesome California Cabernet.
Oh, nice.
And we also did Ian McClagan out at his house in Manor, and with him, cool. It was Guinness. We just had Guinness.
Yeah.
So we forewent the wine, but we did go to his favorite Mexican local Mexican restaurant, and we had a tequila.
Oh, that's good. So did you record that?
Cactus wine. No, that was later. It was after our deal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We did David Brown from KUT.
Yeah.
He's a music guy there, and
So what was it?
Good times.
There were people that knew about beer or wine, or you guys just got drunk and talked shit or something?
Surprisingly, a lot of them did know about wine.
Yeah.
Mike Mills really knew, but he knows more about NCAA basketball.
I see.
And baseball, too. He's a Roberto Clemente.
I see. Are you a baseball guy?
Not so much.
No.
I know the name fastball.
Yeah, I know.
So but I am. I'm definitely more than Miles or Joey.
All right. So you follow, but you're not like not like Corey Glazer.
No, he's a Brewers.
Yeah, yeah,
nut. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I like the Brewers. I grew up with the Brewers. I grew up American League. The Angels was my team in Southern California.
So let's go there. This is Tony Scalzo from Fastball, and you're currently making a solo album.
Yep. And my first solo album.
Is it your first one ever?
Yeah.
Wow.
I made 3 EPs a couple of years ago, but no full-length album that's, you know, a cohesive piece of work.
Right.
So, and that's cool.
Yeah, that is very cool.
I'm working with Steven Bellens. You may know him.
Yeah, I love Steven.
I've been a great, great partner in putting this thing together and really making it. I don't think I could do it by myself.
Playing drums on it as well?
Yeah, he is.
Cool.
That helps a lot.
Yeah.
Because we can change something right away. Plus, we're recording it in a studio that's actually a drum school.
Oh, yeah.
At Herb Bilofsky's house.
Uh-huh.
And so there's everything set up all the time. And, if, you know.
Right.
We can always cut a new track if we want.
Right.
I don't have to depend on anybody really then other than Steven.
So are you playing the bass and guitar and piano and stuff?
Yeah, but I got John Sanchez in there a couple of weeks ago to do a majority of the songs, to just add some second guitar stuff.
Right.
And it's really, I mean, adding him was, wow, it was just really made it.
He added
that third dimension.
Yeah, he broadens the spectrum.
Big time.
Sonically when he's playing.
Big
yeah.
time.
Yeah, I need to get him on here. So Tony Scalzo, you are from Southern California. Is that where you were born?
I was born in Hawaii.
In Hawaii?
Yeah.
So how long did you live there?
Only 2 years. My father was in the Marine Corps.
Okay.
And we traveled. We moved every 2 years and finally settled in 72 in Tustin, California.
Yeah.
Which is about 5 miles from Newport Beach, Costa Mesa area. So I grew up riding my bike to the beach or riding my bike up to the hills or, you know.
Yes, riding your bike, being
or
in Southern
driving
California.
driving up to L.A. for, you know, music and
so when did you get into
punk
music?
Rock
what was
and
the first,
fold.
What was the first, what was the first thing that you heard or you saw that you connected with? Were there musicians in your family that
you
were around?
I was a musician all the time. I mean, I grew up in, you know, Lutheran church.
Right.
There's always, you know, choir, and my mom gave me piano lessons when I was like, I think six or seven. Yeah, my mom was a player in high school. She played saxophone and a little bit of piano, but didn't really pursue it. She got married to my dad young. And so I started doing that. But when I really connected and decided I wanted to be a musician, we were going to the drag races a lot, which was actually a real pastime over there in the 70s, because it wasn't a very populous place, Orange County. It was orange groves and farms and marine bases, two of them there.
So your dad stayed in the Marines after you traveled. He continued.
Yeah, he retired. He retired shortly after we moved there, but then he got a job for a health plan and worked there for a long time.
Okay.
But the race track provided all kinds of rock and roll exposure.
Yeah.
And there was this band, a local Southern California band that may even still be together in some incarnation. But they were, I mean, way back before there was any, you know, rockabilly revivals or, you know.
Like early 70s?
Yeah, there was this band called Flash Cadillac and the Continental Kids. And they were playing after the races right on the tree, you know, right in the, on the drag strip.
Right.
And these guys were making humid pyramids and, you know, they had
on
duck
stage?
Tails and, you know.
Yeah.
It was like Sha-na-na, but, you know, our West Coast version, I guess.
Right.
And they were immensely popular, and it blew me away to hear like Jerry Lee Lewis and, you know, Danny and the Juniors and all that rock and roll stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So I dug all that, and I got into like Chuck Berry and Elvis. My mom was an Elvis fan from way back.
Okay.
She also had like Creedence records, so I was kind of into that thing. And I didn't really know what blues was or anything, I dug what, you know.
You gravitated towards that sort
of. And then, you know, as time went by, I was raised to be a big time reader, so.
Yeah.
I read everything I could read about.
About rock and roll.
Regarding rock and roll, yeah.
You got all the magazines and stuff. Like
there's all these books back then, too, that were famous rock and roll books. There was a book called So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star.
What was that
Which
one?
Is actually almost like a Donald Passman, you know,
book?
Everything You Always Wanted to
Know About Music.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this book was about, you know, it was an early sort of, you know, version of that, you know, what you can expect, watch out for shysters and, you know, that kind of thing. Which I never heeded, by the way.
Copyright your music.
Yeah, all that. Never
send it to yourself. Yeah. Certified mail.
Yeah, that's actually in there. And there was a book called Ups and Downs with the Rolling Stones by Tony Sanchez.
What was that like?
It's just a total like exploitation piece, really.
Right.
About them, you know, in the south of France during, you know,
the exile times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Which you can't beat that.
But was it like the drug stuff and sex
Absolutely,
stuff?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, it was
How old
controversial.
Were you when you read that?
I think it was like 11 or 12.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I got into that kind of stuff very early too. And
did you?
Were
you running with those crowds in those 70s movies? Did you?
Yeah, by the time I was maybe 23, I had done everything you can think of.
When did you start doing it? Were you like a junior high?
My cousin smoked me out when I was like 11, I think. And then I started drinking, my parents' booze and. Till they got rid of it all.
Right. Did they go because of you? Did you have brothers and sisters or anything?
I did, but I was the oldest.
Oh, okay.
And my parents were really worried, and later on, it just got worse and worse, and I quit high school.
You did?
Yeah, I ran with a bunch of, criminals, basically. And by the, by the time I was 23, I'd pretty much had enough, and I basically stopped doing everything.
What was it that was enough? What wasn't?
I was strung out on heroin, man. I was for like 4 years doing it every day.
Wow. And you were playing music at the same time?
I was trying to be in bands, but I was getting fired from bands that were full of junkies that actually would look at me and go, dude, you're just not.
You were like the Steven Adler, like the guy that Guns N' Roses that did too much drugs.
Right. I was the worst kid. I was super irresponsible. I smelled. I was probably like 90 pounds.
It's funny because I know you as a completely different person. I know you as a man, as a father. Right. You know what I mean? As a rock star.
I got my shit together,
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about music. Like, when did you start your first band? Was it with drug buddies and stuff? Or
the first band was not with drug buddies. It was with music buddies. And I wasn't really into the hard stuff yet. And we were just basically forming. I also had a good friend base of intelligent, young, proactive friends that did stuff that were,
active. Not just in a garage.
Yeah, writing songs and
squatting in an empty house
and playing. And we were doing some of the stuff in the scene back in Los Angeles and playing places like the Hong Kong Cafe on Monday night or the Cafe de Grand and.
What year was that? What was the scene?
It's like
the 80, punk scene?
1980, yeah.
New wave
definitely,
scene?
Absolutely. It's right around the time that movie.
Like a music war.
That's 80.
Yeah.
But it was the decline of Western civilization.
Right, right.
And so, boom, that stuff hit like a ton of bricks. I mean, there was always a punk scene.
Right.
But, it was post-college age hipsters from Hollywood. There was the Go-Go's, there was
Did you know
X.
them then? Did you know?
No,
Kathy
they were
Duffin?
Like, they were like, that's like the first generation of that sort of LA scene, the Germs and, it goes on forever. But my scene was sort of like the South Bay, Orange County scene, bands like Black Flag, The Adolescents, TSOL.
And did you do shows
that's what
with them?
I really, yeah. Were, no, no,
those
actually,
the, those were
the music I was playing was not, I've never been in a hardcore band. All the music I've always done is clearly,
right.
Beatle influenced and pop influenced and,
right.
And more rock and roll than the, than the full on click, 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 click,
right.
Go.
Yeah.
I love that stuff and I love to go to shows. I love to, get in the pit and all that stuff and it was just and the chicks were just way more fun but there was a lot of trouble surrounding it too and by 1980 Darby Crash was already dead of a heroin overdose and it seemed like it seems like such a big vast time to me now
right
and yet it was only a couple of years and then boom and it's like Henry joins Black Flag. It becomes a national scene, becomes an international thing.
Right.
And then there's, but that's when I started reading about how bands like toured. And I was like, wow, how do I get the hell out of California and go, play in,
right.
DC or New York or Austin.
Right.
Shreveport, I mean, I knew about New Orleans. The Austin scene and everything and the big boys. And I really, just wanted to find a way to make the music take me where I wanted to go.
Right.
But,
was that hard to do then?
I didn't understand how. I don't think it was any harder than it is now.
Right.
But I just, you know, I was too dumb and young and inexperienced to figure it out. But boy, once I got out here, which I moved here in 93, my whole deal just accelerated, you know. It's almost like
so
going
in California,
to another...
In California, you just kind of played in bands and...
I never got paid in California. I played in bands. I did some recording. Most I ever got paid, I think, was like $180 I made one night when the band I was in, Tender Fury, played.
That's a good name.
Tender Fury is actually an offshoot of TSOL, the original,
oh, really?
With Jack Grisham.
Oh, wow.
And we were more of a rock band, you know.
Okay.
So we would places, we would do stuff with like Ricky Rockman and the Hollywood metal scene, you know.
And
we'd open up for Bang Tango.
Right, were you in, were you in that sort of like a
Well, yeah, the
late
80s I was,
yeah?
Because see that, and Guns N' Roses and that whole deal was it was, the lines got really blurred around 88. There was, you know, you didn't know what was metal, what was rock.
What was
remember
pop?
The Cult?
Yeah.
The Cult was all
like
a Hollywood
music
band.
And rock and roll, yeah.
Yeah, and the girls were just so, you know, it was all like white-skinned girls with really bright...
And crabs.
Lots of crabs. Dude, I don't know how many times, but black hair, you know, and you know that whole sort of punk, but like, what's punk anymore, right? And so that scene was kind of hard to, you know, which was great for me because I've never been satisfied just, you know, sitting on one style or one thing, you know.
Yeah,
I actually got really into, you know, I met Rosie Flores out there,
really?
And you know, and seeing bands like Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs, which is straight R&B band from Hollywood.
Yeah. Rosie's a fucking amazing
guitar player. Was out there.
I got to see her play a couple of times recently.
She was in Screaming Sirens back then.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we actually had a great Americana scene, which didn't call itself it that.
Right.
Yet. You know, there was the Blasters.
Right.
You know, and X had like the Knitters thing. So I was getting into, I didn't know anything about, you know, modern country or Nashville country, but I sure knew about Hank Williams and George Jones and all because of these great people that would tell me about it.
Right.
And, you know, it really worked for me when I got here to Austin because I'm the first band I saw in Austin, first night here, I went to Antone's. What?
Before you say that, what was the impetus that took you out of LA and brought you here then?
I'll get to that.
Okay, go ahead. So you get to Antone's.
I mean, I saw the Paladins, who actually coincidentally played the other night here, and you know, and they're from San Diego, but just sort of.
They used to tour a lot. I used to see them in Houston.
Sure.
At little, like almost
and
like
Mojo,
restaurant kind of
Mojo
gigs.
Nixon too.
As well. Yeah.
You know, that was really great for me once I got here because I had some place to go.
Right.
I met Rick Broussard pretty quick.
Okay.
Going to see Two Hoots and
who was the band that you saw at Antone's?
Paladins
is who you
I
saw.
Remember
okay.
It was the Paladins, and it was, check this out, it was Carolyn Wonderland playing at in Austin from Houston.
Right.
She must have been
still had
like,
pink hair.
Man, she must no, she had blonde hair.
She had blonde hair then? Okay.
She must have been like 20 years old.
Yeah.
21.
Yeah, she was really young.
I was 24, 25, something like that.
Yeah.
And let's see, I was actually 28 when I moved to Austin.
Yeah.
I moved to Austin. I was playing in a band with some guys in Orange County. We were doing fairly well. We were making records, singles, 7 inches.
Right.
We were playing gigs, good gigs, you know, opening up for bigger bands in theaters and stuff and doing pretty good. But then a friend of mine, Scott Parker, had called and said, there's this guy in Austin, he's making a record, he's signed to my company that I work for, Lightstorm Records,
right?
Which is James Cameron's company, actually.
Okay.
Lightstorm. He had, right before he started work on Titanic, he had this aspiration to be a music mogul, and he hired a bunch of people, and they had a record company. And the two people on the label were Beaver Nelson, our own Beaver Nelson from Austin, and Ice-T.
Wow.
Believe it or not.
What an odd combo.
Yeah. So anyway, the idea was me and another guy, Jamie Reedling, a drummer who was in my band at the time. We were proposed to come out to Austin, move to Austin, bring our families.
Right.
We both had little babies.
Right.
Girlfriends and little babies.
Yeah.
Can you move out, join this guy, Beaver Nelson's band? And I guess they thought, take Beaver Nelson, add two Southern California punk rock guys, and it becomes the Replacements for some
somehow.
Reason, right?
Yeah.
And it just never really worked out. I mean, Beaver will tell you, I mean, we struggled. We tried to make it happen. There were bright moments.
You were playing bass?
I've always admired his... I was playing bass.
Okay.
Paul Miner was playing guitar.
Okay.
Joey became the drummer after this guy, Jamie.
And that, is that how you met Joey and
yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah. So
sorry.
The drummer that was with us, he couldn't take it anymore. He hated living here. It was too hot.
Right.
He wanted to go surfing. He could not handle it. He split. And Joey came in. And Joey and I actually went out to Memphis with Paul and Beaver, and we went and made a record out there, which has never come out, never seen the light of day, even... You know, now, even, you know, almost right. 20 years down the line.
With like a famous producer or anything like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, well, a little bit. Joe Blaney. And actually, he's going to mix my record. But
oh, really?
Joe Blaney recorded Combat Rock.
Oh, wow.
He was the engineer on Combat Rock, and he mixed it. And he also was the engineer on both Keith Richards records. So he has a great... And since then, he's made a lot of really successful Latin American rock records. That's been sort of his niche.
Cool.
Turning South American guys into the Ramones.
Right.
Anyway, I'm looking forward to going up to Woodstock and working with him on this record. Again, I haven't seen him in years, but... Anyway, working with Joey during that got me with him, and he had worked with Miles in his band.
Big Car.
You probably remember Big Car
here.
And they were signed to Giant, so they had experience with a major label.
Right.
We formed this band after Miles came over to my house, much like A Night Tonight.
Right.
We listened to records. We played each other songs. We decided to start practicing. Within 2 weeks, we were gigging. We were playing The Hole in the Wall. We were playing what's now Opal Divines was a place called the Stonehouse Brewery
or something
like that.
Yeah.
So we were playing, and we were playing covers and playing our own original songs, and it didn't not take very long to...
No, it didn't.
I mean,
I
within...
It well. Yeah,
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 it's very weird. I mean, I think it took about 3 months before we had two label guys from Hollywood Records at the Hole in the Wall coming to see Magneto USA, which
is
the first name of Fastball. And I happen to know one of the guys. It's total... coincidence because, you know, I'd worked out in L.A. And
right.
Julian Raymond was a producer and a VP of A&R at Hollywood. And him and Rob Seidenberg came and watched us. And they decided, you know, right then and there, they were going to sign Magneto USA. And he said, meet me out in New York when you guys are doing CMJ, because we were going to see CMJ in September of 94.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was September 94. I got married in December 94. And then by that time, we were on the road. We got us a van. We were playing little clubs all over, up to like Iowa and, you know, college stuff.
Right.
We were recording. We made a record out in Hollywood, and it tanked. It didn't do anything, but we were still
make your mama proud.
Yes.
Okay.
And we were still being pushed as.
I remember you guys. Sorry to interrupt, but I remember you guys had a cassette because I had
a
Magneto cassette.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That Miles gave me.
Yeah, five sound cassette.
Yeah. And was that kind of the thing that got y'all signed, or how did you guys? What was it?
It was part of it. It was sort of our demo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so then you made the Make Your Mama Proud record.
Yeah.
And I saw you guys touring with Matthew Sweet on that.
Yeah, that was 95. So we had been signed for a little less than a year. We got a manager. We went out on the road with Matthew Sweet. I got to see Matthew Sweet band, which to this day, I mean, has some of the same guys in it.
Yeah.
It's just one of the most amazing.
Was Rick Mank playing drums?
He was.
Yeah.
Tony Marsico on bass from the Plugs and Crusados and Ivan, oh God, what's his last name? But he was in Richard Hell and the Voidoids.
Yeah.
I mean, it was sick. They were great. I saw them probably more than any band I've ever seen live because every night, you know, 42 nights, I saw those guys every night, and I never got sick of it. Just amazing.
So the record tanked, but you did this tour, and at that point, Matthew Sweet was doing pretty well, and you guys, I mean...
Matthew, yeah, I mean, he was 120 minutes, superstar, you know?
Yeah, like that alternative rock and roll kind of guy. And what do you think was the problem then with what did, was it kind of mishandled?
You didn't have the hit. That's not a strong record. I mean, it's just a bunch of yelling and screaming, really. I mean, it's streamlined, it's almost punk... It's almost a hardcore thing. It just doesn't really make it. It's not really us. It doesn't really... I think we were headed somewhere. We weren't sure yet. But we were, you know, after that, 97, summer of 97, we go in the studio again. And we're not sure what we're going to do. And we're thinking maybe we're going to get dropped because our last record only sold like 1,000 copies or whatever.
Right.
Nationwide. And we start work on this record and manage to get in and out of that studio without anybody really, you know, dropping us or.
Right. Well, as a songwriter, you know, and as like a front person of the band, was there a tremendous amount of pressure when you went back in to do that next record?
No, because
was it just
kind of
like we got nothing to lose?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We thought that we were done. We were thinking about, well, you know, we did our best. It didn't really pan out like we thought it might. But I had some demos that I played for the A&R guy, and we decided to record them. And, you know, along with
Was it Miles's Julian Raymond? And Rob
Rob Seidenberg, yeah. And he produced the one. Well, actually, he didn't produce the one before. This is the first time we'd worked with Julian on the record, was the second record.
Okay. Who did the first one?
Jerry Finn.
I don't know.
The late Jerry Finn. He just passed away a couple years ago, but he mixed Dookie.
Worked
with Rob Cavallo on that. He produced two Rancid records, you know, Offspring.
Okay, so let's go up to the next record.
I mean, that's kind of the way that record sounded. Bad Religion Bad Religion or something.
Yeah.
So I had these sort of poppy tunes, you know, this, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. When I submitted the demo of The Way, it didn't sound much different than, I have it still somewhere, the cassette, you know, the 4-track cassette.
I think I heard that.
Of The Way? I don't know, maybe. I might have played it for you before it even came
Jason's.
Out.
Remember Jason? He used to live here, and then he moved back here. And
Jason Austin?
Back. No. I'm drawing a blank on his name, on his last name. He's a good friend. He's a friend of mine, and I'm trying to hurt your feelings, Jason. But he's a friend of yours too. So, but anyway, go ahead. I think I might have heard it from him. So
we recorded that, and once that was mixed and everything, Rob had played it for a few people in the industry, and next thing you know, there's all these people moving from different labels. We couldn't really tell. We knew something was happening, but we didn't get it. All these people started moving to Hollywood Records. Hollywood was, by the way, without a head. There was no president. They had fired their president.
Okay. A giant snake, like Disney.
Yeah,
snake.
So they didn't really. That's probably why we hadn't gotten dropped, because there was no one to drop us.
Right.
No one to make that decision.
Yeah, no one noticed.
But we're in there, and next thing you know, Bob Cavallo, Big Bob, there's two Cavallos, there's Rob Cavallo
and
Bob.
Yeah.
Bob's the dad. Bob is the big manager of Christina Aguilera, Goo Goo Dolls, I mean, it's huge,
right,
Prince.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's sick. But Bob became the president, and everybody was saying, well, he came here to your label because of this song. And we had some other people, like Mark DiDio came from Capital, I think, and all these people
this
start converging on you know, Buena Vista Avenue going the Disney lot, and that's where Hollywood Records is.
Right.
And they started pushing it before we even finished the record. I mean, the packaging wasn't even together yet. And College stations and
okay, they started kind of taking.
Yeah,
it
well, different markets across the country started playing, and they started getting all these calls. Like, what the hell?
Yeah,
who is this? What is this?
Yeah.
So it came out, and by the time the record wasn't even out. I think the radio was on like a number 15 on the alternative charts nationwide. Yeah. So K Rock, we're all of a sudden we're in K Rock, my old station from back in
at that point K Rock was a taste making
absolutely
radio. You got
still,
added to K Rock.
In fact,
United
I would
States.
Say Fastball is probably with a few other bands. We're the last. That's it, man. We're the last of the 20th century bands where they really threw money at you and said, you've done it now. Boom. You know, that sort of started with, that big buzz with Nirvana and, all of a sudden indie bands getting signed to majors and selling millions of records.
Right.
We hadn't sold, millions of records yet.
Yeah.
But it looked like we were going to, and we started, it just took off.
So just on a personal level, I mean, just
and they knew it. That's the freaky part is that they knew.
They knew it was coming.
And Bob Cavallo, I was in the bathroom with Bob Cavallo, and we're like, next to each other.
Right.
And he goes, boy, it's number 15 now. I think that next week it's going to be number 11, and then maybe get down to, but I mean, it actually made it to the number one slot on the alternative charts. It's like he knew, like clockwork, how it was going to go. And it went that way. And he said he wasn't sure about number one, but,
right.
And once it got there.
Like someone touched you on the head with their magic wand.
But you know what? I can pinpoint the moment that I knew that the arc had been crested. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like you're number one. Well, there's nowhere to go.
That's it.
But back up.
Right. Yeah.
And I'll be damned if it didn't happen that way. And it was, I think the out of my head.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Fire Escape charted at something like 39 or something. So it was a top 40 hit. And then out of my head made it to something like 15, maybe 20. So top 20 hit. And that really helped everything for the next 2 years. But then we had to make another record.
Right.
And we did all the same stuff that we did on the
first record.
As far as promo goes, we did all the TV stuff, but it started becoming less and less. By 2002, I think, I was already playing in Young Heart Attack with
Frenchie
and Steve and Joey, who joined that band later, actually. And we weren't doing very much after that. We did...
Well, in that situation, like when you went in to make the record, then... after you had this massive success.
The third record. A lot of people think it's our second record, but our third
record. What's the name of that record?
It's called The Harsh Light of Day. And it's just so telling. I mean,
so telling.
Not only that, it's almost like that Spinal Tap scene when they, the Black album. And it's like, it's just, you invent your future, You want to paint yourself black. You want to turn it into this dark thing. That's the way it's going to be. I mean, it shows us on the cover looking out this window, right, from a building, looking down. And we joked about it like, there goes the limo, driving away. And all the label guys are all splitting now. And there they go. And that's exactly what happened. People started leaving the label, and none of those people talk to me today, except Rob. None of them. Yeah. Rob Seidenberg does. He's my friend.
Yeah. No.
They're all gone.
Same experience. I've got one dude. Yeah. You probably know Tom DeSavia.
Oh, sure.
Right. Tom was a VP at Elektra when we were on there, and same thing.
He's a friend still on Facebook. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a real person.
Absolutely. I like all those people. I like Loretta and him. And
yeah. All that. So let me ask you this: you're taking off, and that the way is taking off, and you're aware of the arc, and you can tell, you can feel these certain things. How did you handle that, like, as a person?
Well, I didn't interpret it correctly.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that I was aware. I said, now in retrospect I
can
pinpoint
it. Sorry, you're right.
But I was a fool, man. I thought, well, this record sold a million copies.
The next one's going to sell
6 million.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I figured that's the way it goes. But see, they didn't really want to work it. They didn't like... There's all kinds of factors. But I mean, the main thing was we weren't a cohesive unit. And Miles and I were on different trajectories.
Yeah.
Aesthetically and career-wise.
Yeah.
The label sensed that they couldn't figure out what to do with us.
Wow.
There's two front guys. They don't even know what they are.
Right.
This band doesn't have a well-defined character.
Yeah. There's no, yeah.
So, you know, and I was really, I could say that I was really, I want to use the word, what's the word where you don't care anymore?
Yeah, you're apathetic at that point.
Yeah.
I know that feeling. I mean, that happens, but like, were there times when you were like, you weren't like, oh, I have to kind of bring this in.
Well, I figured,
like,
I had
Miles,
enough money.
Let's sit down and talk about this. Oh, yeah.
I figured I had enough money, and it actually took me a long time to realize how much money I had. And just as quickly, or just as slowly for me to realize that how much money I did have, it took me a really long time to figure out that I don't have a lot of money, and that no money is going to be coming, and that I'm going to have to
go back. And
yeah.
Work.
And I mean, it took me a long time to figure out I could spend my money on this and yada, yada, and fine wines and killer weed and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And you know what? I had to slowly cut back, and now I live like a normal person. Right.
Right.
But 10 years ago,
you're living the dream.
9 years ago. Yeah. I was splurging. I was going on road trips by myself, taking my MDX, you know, across the country 3 times a year, and staying in hotels, and just because I felt like it or whatever, you know. And I would never think of doing that today. I mean, I wouldn't, you know.
Were you writing and shit when you were doing that? Were you taking stuff
a little bit?
Were you on this sort of like, hey,
absolutely,
I'm going on this journey to find something else about myself? And
I never really lost any kind of creativity as a result of it. But you know, what can I say? It was a ride. That's all it ever is.
Yeah.
And I remember being told that by some people when we were in the, you know, in the thick of it,
yeah.
Saying, you know, boy, this ain't gonna last forever. Remember, you better enjoy yourself. You know, and I would kind of like smirk and say, yeah, well, you don't know what you're talking about or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But they were right, absolutely right. And, you know.
Well, did you enjoy it ultimately?
I was unhappy.
You were?
Ultimately?
Yeah.
Unhappy.
Why is that?
Well.
So there was, it was a vapid existence. You were.
I drank.
Yeah.
I got into drinking probably around 99, I think. I started, and I had been sober for 10 years.
Okay.
And I made up for lost time. And then I started actually taking, you know.
Was it ego that you were like, oh, I can start drinking?
Yes.
Fuck it. I'm fucking.
It was all kinds of
the
stuff.
The guy that wrote The Way.
Well, I was also unhappy. My marriage wasn't working out because, and you know my wife very well, but, you know, it, I was gone for 3 years.
Yeah.
And not, are you not, supposed to have a.
Right. And not just physically gone, but probably,
you know,
mentally gone.
And I was. Out in
space, you're drinking, you're popping pills, smoking weed, and
I was definitely, you know, tapping,
you
know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it ruined. I ruined my relationship with my wife.
Yeah,
and it was irreparable.
Yeah,
and it's all because of my inflated ego and my inflated sense of superiority.
And even at that age, because it even came to you not when you were like in your late teens, early 20s. You
God saw
probably.
Fit to give it to me later in life because I wouldn't have made it.
Right.
If I was 25 and I'd had all that success,
no way.
There's no way. Yeah. I would have been dead. And so I'm grateful for that I was able to, you know, but I got close, man. I got some scary moments there where I was, you know, laying in a hotel, passed out, you know. I could take like 10 Vicodins and drink with it, you know.
Yeah.
Get on a plane to Japan.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, it was intense.
Yeah.
I slowly, you know, came back to earth.
Yeah, how did you get yourself back? I mean, was it that success started leaving and then you realized,
I tell you what,
once
I got divorced from my first wife, I was living on my own here in Austin. I rented a house and I started, you know, really, you'd see me around town all the time, and I'm not proud, but I mean, I was kind of obnoxious. I'd be, you know, people would literally, you know, see me and turn around.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a good time. I had some fun. But it started, you know, and then I went to, I went to a doctor and for some routine checkup, and they told me, you got Hep C.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, shit.
That was when I was
what does that mean, right?
Yeah.
You know, and well, it means that you got this virus, and if you continue doing what you're doing while you have this virus,
right,
you're going to die. You're going to get liver cancer or worse. And, you know, your liver's not that badly damaged yet, but it will be. So I had to come to grips with that, and it actually took a while, you know, for me to really figure out what I needed to do. But I went and I got myself, you know, the treatment and everything. I did 6 months of interferon. I quit drinking for that time, you know, and, managed to stay sober after for a little while, but I, basically just got my shit together, you know, again, and that really knocked me for a loop too, because I was really, that medicine makes you pretty sick.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I was down to 138 pounds. I mean, I'm 180 pounds now.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was like,
You were really.
Yeah. And I looked crazy, and people thought I was really on drugs. And that's the ironic part, is I was actually trying to take care of myself.
Right.
And people thought I was, and I had to take tons of pain medication too during that time, which was more of a chore than any fun. It was definitely no fun. I mean, especially when you have to work.
Yeah.
I had to play some dates, and people, there's some pictures on the internet where you can see, you know, fastball. And I had really short hair at the time.
Yeah.
So I really looked really, really skinny.
Yeah.
And those pictures really put me in a, you know, wow, look at that.
Yeah.
Look at how you are now, and look at how you were then.
Yeah.
And, I met my wife, my current wife, Jennifer, you know, just before that time. She helped me with that. We weren't living together. We slowly made this relationship, you know, happen. And we got married, you know, 5 years after we met. We didn't get married till 3 years. Actually, today's our anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
It's not really our date anniversary. Okay. Like, it's actually December 16th.
Okay.
But today's the day because it was Tuesday.
All right.
That's what she said. So
yeah.
I'm going with that. Yeah, we got married 3 years ago, and after being together for 5 years or so. And so we've been together for a long time. She went through her own medical thing just recently. She had breast cancer.
Right.
Everything you could do about breast cancer. She's totally great. She's pregnant.
And Annette did. Oh, she is. Congratulations.
She's big time pregnant. She's going to be popping a kid out probably in 4 weeks, I want to say.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how many is this for you?
It'll be four.
Four?
Yeah.
Wow.
I have a 19-year-old daughter.
Wow.
I have a 13-year-old daughter. I have a 9-year-old son and another son on the way. And my life, I'm at 47 now. I still get to do really awesome stuff.
Yeah.
I get to go and play one-offs with fastball.
Right.
Come home with a, you know, handful of money.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
You know what that's like, because you guys do the, you know, the corporate gigs and stuff. And
yeah.
It's fantastic because I'm not in the van for 6 weeks.
Right.
I'm not.
You don't hate anyone. You're happy to see everyone.
No, and I'm, you know.
I thought you meant no. Like, I'm still not happy to see him, but
I am. I actually, enjoy the fan thing better.
Yeah.
I have a. Some of my fans have actually turned their backs on me because I'm such a dick to them sometimes. For that, I apologize, but I mean, you know.
And what is that? Do you feel, do you have like this, I just saw this movie with this guy with Rush documentary. Did you see that documentary?
It's no, but I'd like to.
How the drummer, Neil Peart's kind of like, look, I play this show as like.
Right.
I don't.
He's idolized by millions, obviously.
Yeah, I don't need to know how much you love me or how much I change your life.
It's difficult to hear that stuff.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
So
when they want to, they want me to hear stuff,
right?
A lot of times on my Facebook, somebody will put a video of them doing some song, and I, I remove it because I mean, look, this is my Facebook. It's about me. It's about my career. So, and they get angry, and I'm like, what can I say? Sorry. And I, you know, that doesn't really bother me that much, by the way. I mean,
no,
I'm sorry about it, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it.
Right.
I care about, you know, I care about my friends, but I really care about my little circle.
Yeah.
And
of course,
I have to focus on that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, we all do.
And whatever I'm doing right now, I'm not trying to become some kind of star.
You're
I'm
not
trying to make music and put it out. And so I have something to play new for you people when I go out and play shows.
Right.
And I don't care if I'm playing in front of a stadium crowd. I'd much rather play in, you know, a nice intimate place. I'd much rather do, frankly, I'd much rather do just rock clubs, you know.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. I'm also doing lots of side stuff. You know, I play piano now in Texas Tycoons, which I've been doing
for which I love.
Almost 2 years now.
Yeah.
And Alter Ego, which is a cover band, you know, we work with.
The Texas Tycoons is the one that does all the Texas
Yes.
music.
Everything we do is done by Texas artists.
Yeah.
With a few exceptions. We do Galveston by Jimmy Webb.
About Texas.
From Oklahoma. Yeah. So it's gotta fall into a certain thing. The other night we played at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston, where, as you may know, is where King Tut is right now.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So did you play King
Tut?
We
did. We learned King Tut by Steve Martin from Waco, Texas, and we did. We played King Tut for King Tut.
Very nice.
And my wife's been driven crazy
by King
Tut. That's all I've been talking about.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, she's
boom, boom.
King Tut. Buried with a donkey.
So you guys, in Fastball, you guys put out two or three records after you left Hollywood, two?
We left Hollywood. We got signed. We left Hollywood after three records.
Right.
Make Your Mama Proud.
All the pain money can buy.
And Harsh Light of Day. That's three full length albums. Then we got signed to Ryka, which I couldn't have been happier about. Right.
Right.
I'm thinking, wow, Elvis Costello, Zappa.
Yeah.
You know, just Big a stars. Million great. Yeah. I mean, it goes on forever. This catalog. Right. And they were trying to become a viable, fresh, you know, music label
as opposed
to a catalog only thing. But it didn't really work out. We got to make the record. We made a great record with Mike McCarthy.
Right. Who I love.
What's it called? The record.
I don't know. I know what it looks like in my mind.
It's red and white.
Yeah, I remember it from from Jupiter Records.
So we made that record and unfortunately, we got dropped by Ryko like as soon as it came out.
And then?
Because they just changed their minds, decided to become a catalog label again. And
No
tour support. We toured once. It didn't work out. Went home and I think that's when we took a little break. Oh, yeah. I started working on solo stuff and working on Jennifer.
Yeah.
I was really courting Jennifer, and I think we did some international stuff. We went out to Miles and I went out to London. We did a UK promo, you know, just blitzkrieg. Did all the radio and TV stuff we could
do. Did you guys do really well over? It was like when
no, I mean
all the
no.
pain money came by. Was that a
during,
worldwide
look,
hit?
During all the pain money can buy. Every place we went, we were in the top 10. So we did. We did, you know, Top of the Pops. We did.
You did?
Sure.
Wow.
Yeah. We did Top of the Pops with Culture Club, Shania Twain, Ash, a couple other bands.
I remember Ash.
And we went and partied with Boy George that night. Ash is a great band from Ireland.
Yeah. How was Boy George to party with?
That's awesome.
Close to death, right?
Great guy. He was actually good at that time.
Okay.
This was before the neck thing he had going, weird cocaine freak.
Yeah.
But he was super nice, and he's like, you know, come on out to the Met Bar, you know, I'll make sure you get in, and which is a difficult place to get in. We get in there, there's Bjork, there's, you know, Noel Gallagher, and
wow,
it was just sick, right? There's the Chemical Brothers over there, and, you know, it's that kind of scene.
Yeah,
so
that was wild.
That's back in the 99. When we went back, Miles and I went back to London to do, and we're not even a full band, we're just acoustic.
Right.
So we got this gig that the label set up at Water Rats in King's Cross part of London, and just a little shithole where people, you know, where, you know, up and coming bands play.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's like final game of Euro Cup, right?
Yeah.
And it's Portugal and England, and England loses after, like, you know, overtime. And the place just cleared out. And we bet that, well, if England wins, well, then everybody want to hang out and party. And
yeah. And if they lose,
England
well,
lost. Yeah. We lost. Even the guy, there was a guy from, I think, a writer from Mojo there, and we tried desperately to keep him in the room, and he's like, right. Sorry, mate. Yeah, I'm out of here. And we did a few. We did a great little Spanish tour, which was incredible.
Yeah.
And I got to take my new girlfriend, Jennifer, and
yeah.
Miles took his wife, and we all went out to Spain, and we stayed in great hotels, and the company that brought us out was just like, couldn't have been cooler. We played this giant mod festival. For some reason in Spain, we get sort of like bunched in with the mod scene, with this sort of psychedelic.
Yeah.
But not really, because like this festival we played at, we headlined the middle night.
Right.
And the night before was the Undertones, one of my favorite bands ever. Another Irish band. And on the last night, it was the Zombies.
Wow.
With Colin and...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was sick. It was the Zombies. And like, what? We're headlining, you know,
the same... Yeah, along with the Zombies.
Yeah, and I remember getting like three encores. Because we busted out Volver, Volver in Spanish.
Yeah.
So, wow, you know. That was pretty much... that's the last time we played... outside of the U.S. That was 2005, December. Right. Yeah.
And then you put out another record kind of on your own?
We put out a record on our own, and I think it's our best record.
Yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah, I still can't remember that. These last two records, I can't, the titles. I know it sounds stupid, but I can't remember the names of the tracks on my record, so...
That's all right. Yeah. So who else are you playing side? Aren't you playing, weren't you playing with... God, I'm drawing a blank on his name. Ben Queller as well? Or are you not doing that?
I did a pickup gig with Ben.
Okay.
I've known Ben since he was 15, since he was, you know, Radish.
Right, yeah.
They got signed to Mercury, and we were on tour with them. And
oh, really?
Radish was opening up for Fastball on one of our early tours. And, you know, obviously he's... done pretty well for himself.
Yeah.
He actually has the kind of career that I, you know, would much rather have than the career that, you know, the one we had.
Right.
All it did was really, I mean, it's given me something that I can use forever. Still, I can't deny that the benefits of that. However, I don't think I'm as equipped to deal with this kind of thing. Maybe Miles can handle it more, but for me, the success was just a little too much. And even being in Austin, it was difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
Some of my friends were kind of uncool about it, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't feel any different, you know.
Right.
And I think I might have gone out of my way to prove that I was, you know.
Yeah, still down, you know, man.
Indie.
Right, yeah.
All that kind of stuff. That's why I wanted to play with Frenchie and Steve. And,
right. That's why I still drive a 1987 Corolla.
Well,
Yeah.
My one nice car that I got, I drove it into the ground, so
it's gone.
Yeah, and whatever. Those things are dumb, by the
way. Yeah.
All that stuff, man, I watch people. I can't think of a bigger dick than somebody driving around with a Ferrari, you know?
In Austin.
Or anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Anywhere, unless it's on a racetrack.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're a race driver, then I understand that. But I mean, here's a $100,000, $200,000 car. What's your problem?
Yeah.
What heading is down your a hole problem? In the wall. Yeah.
I'm going to go 35 miles an hour down Guadalupe.
Or any of that. What about the houses and all that stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, who needs all that stuff? Yeah. I mean, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen? And what about paying all the taxes and all that? You know, when you live in a nice neighborhood, you got to pay $10,000.
Yeah, yeah. Just because.
For property taxes?
Yeah. Well, so what? Tell me about this record now.
The one I'm working on.
Yeah.
Okay. Well. some of the songs are actual songs that were going to be fastball songs.
Uh-huh.
Here's the secret to this record, I think, is that it's almost a fastball record, but it's the fastball record that I don't have to worry about Joey and Miles telling me they don't want the song to go like
right,
that.
Right, right.
So I can take these songs that are co-writes with Miles
right.
and just, well, I'm going to use these words.
Right.
And he can't say nothing about it, but he gets credited and yeah. he gets, you know,
yeah.
he gets a piece
yeah.
if anything ever happens to it, which I hope it will, frankly. Yeah. I mean, I really would like to see something happen with this. I think it's possible.
I'm really excited to hear it.
If you like my music, then you'll like this record. Yeah, I mean, it's basically melodic rock.
Yeah.
I didn't put any country songs on this one. I didn't. It's basically just.
And are you when you're writing, are you, does stuff come out that's personal just because it comes out subconsciously because you're telling a story, or are you like a guy that tells a story about like what is this record like focusing kind of on the last few years of your life, or no?
It depends.
Okay.
You know, I mean,
you've got those.
It depends song by song.
Yeah.
There are some songs on there that are definite. I don't want to say autobiographical, but they apply to me directly as what's going on in my
sure.
life. There's a song on there, you know, that's a total, you know, a salute to my wife or whatever.
Yeah.
It's called Forever Girl. I got a lot of songs called Girl that go girl, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We've talked about this before. And I got a song called Halfway Girl and a song called Forever Girl on this record. And I remember we played a couple shows, one at the Cactus and one at Lucky Duck.
Yeah,
where I had this song Reality. And
I don't know if I remember it.
Well, it's one of the ones I played, and I was still working on it way back then, you know, and it's going to be on there. And
cool.
So I would say half of the songs are songs that I wrote on my own.
Right.
And then half of the songs are co-writes with different people. Actually, there's a co-write on there with Corey Glazer.
Oh, excellent.
Uh-huh. We have a song. He doesn't even really know that it's his song.
What a nice
surprise,
though.
I don't even know if he knows that he's on it, but he came up with this progression one day at my house, and I sort of ran with it, turned it into a song.
Right.
And it's called Looks Like I've Thrown It All Away, and it's one of my favorites right now. And so, you know, that's on there, and for the most part, it's just hooky melodic rock.
Good.
I think that most of the songs are really strong.
When do you think you'll be finished with it?
I'll be finished in a couple weeks, but okay. Then I got to plan the mixing thing and
right.
And you know, I did this through Kickstarter, so
oh, you did?
It keeps me awake at night, the fact that I haven't finished it yet. But I've tried to get in the studio whenever I had a chance to do it. It's taken longer. But I'm glad it's taken longer because it's built well. I mean, yeah. This record's built really well.
I'm really looking forward to hearing it. Are you guys going to mix it yourselves? Or are you?
I'm
going
to take it up to Woodstock
to Joe Blaney's studio.
Yeah,
right.
and have Steve and I are going to go up there and do that.
Fantastic.
And he's been hearing, you know, little bits of it.
Yeah.
So, and we're, you know, working close with him. See, this is another benefit, you know, rather than just showing up with masters and going, boom, do something with this in a week. He's, you know, had a chance to get the gist of what we're doing. And I know it's going to be for the benefit of the record.
I know that this is kind of late in the podcast to bring this up, but do you feel like that kind of shift in the industry? Like for instance, this guy, Tim Palmer, you know who I'm talking about? He's a guy who makes Pearl Jam 10 and.
Oh, he did?
A bunch of, you know, tons of shit, like tons and tons of shit.
Right.
He moved here and he lives here, and you can just like tweeted him, you know, just didn't know him, and was like, hey, you worked on this record. Do you want to, you know, can I interview you for my podcast? And he was like, yeah, of course. So I feel like at some point, like back in the time of the actual music business and even towards the end of the late 90s, you couldn't just tweet Jack Joseph Puig and be like, hey, dude, you want to meet me at Denny's and I'll interview you for my interview thing?
No, because you know those guys were busy as hell. That's
right.
Why.
So do you feel like now you can reach this mixing guy, if you were on a label and this was back then, he would have just gotten the record right when it was done. You would have had
week
now.
That's
he's kind of like you're broing out a little bit and you're like, hey, you know.
It's totally true. And in fact, you could go to probably Jack Joseph Puig.
Probably,
or you could go to Well,
whoever.
Miles
yeah.
has a great relationship with yeah. Bob Clearmountain, who mixed the last two fastball records.
Right, and he did some Bob on his record, too.
Bob Clearmountain's done probably 500
yeah.
records by people that you know yeah. as household names.
Yeah, you two.
Jackson Brown, the Rolling yeah. Stones. Boom. I mean, it's sick.
Yeah.
And he can do that now. I mean, back in those days in the late 90s,
right,
those people were so busy and so making so much money.
Yeah, yeah. That they didn't have time for...
You know that we used to go into A&M studios, and I think it was something like $1,700 a day just flat for the studio time. You know, that's not counting...
The dudes.
Yeah, all the dudes. The second engineer,
yeah.
the first engineer...
The runners.
The guitar tech, the runners. You know, to think of the money that
I like that it's itself tightened its own belt, because there was a point.
It's gotten
there.
Saner. Yeah. I believe it's gotten saner. And, you know, but I got to say that on the other hand of that, there's something to be said for being treated like your music is super important.
Yeah.
Even if it's an overblown
yeah.
concept
yeah, yeah, yeah.
that, you
there's
know,
like
we're the Rolling Stones.
Wait, Mr. Scalzo,
now.
You right. want a Snickers bar? No, I'll go get it for you. That right. whole runner's thing I always enjoy.
Right. It's cool. yeah. And plus, but then you tend to also back away from your stuff.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, I just sang it 7 times.
Right.
Now, while you're comping the vocals, I'm going to go
right.
drink some wine and eat, you know, filet mignon
yeah.
in the room.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to play some video games.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah, I've done all those things.
That's not good. That's
yeah,
not
yeah,
proactive.
Yeah, no,
that's
no, no,
not
no.
a good way to
No, and now, you know, you're at Steven.
Stay connected.
You're out at Herb Bilofsky's, you know, with Steven. You don't.
It's not comfortable in there. I will say that it
yeah.
is not comfortable. You,
but
there's
you
no
stay
place
and then you
to
work.
Sit.
Yeah.
There's no couch. There's none of that. But I got to say, before I got all the money from the Kickstarter thing
right.
to make this thing happen, to actually go to work,
yeah.
I got this letter from this guy saying, you know, what the hell, you know, what you really should do is just invest, you know, a couple $1,000s on a Pro Tools rig, get a good mic, yada, yada, yada. I'm like, dude, do you even know what you're yeah. talking about? I mean, come on. I mean, sure, I'm not going to go to A&M and spend $1,700
right.
a day.
But at the same time.
But I mean, at the same time, you know, I want to put the drums on tape.
Yeah.
I want to use 11 mics on my drum set.
Yeah, yeah.
I want, because look, that's how we make those
yeah.
records sound the way
yeah.
they do. And if you don't believe me, that's just too bad.
Yeah.
You know? And I got, the guy was so awful about it, man. Just nasty. Because he had to end the whole letter by saying, by the way, fastball sucks, or something like that, you know? He had to say, had to put that in there, you know? Hey, I know we suck.
So the guy actually sat there and,
you know?
And spent time writing an email to tell you
yeah,
what to do, but at the same time...
I don't know what it... I don't know. And the interesting thing is where you're trying to hurt me,
well,
trying to hurt my feelings, because it did a little bit.
Yeah,
but then
I'm
he
sure.
tried to be... He tried to turn it around in subsequent... correspondences. I don't know why I was even engaging the guy, but he tried to be nice.
I do that every once in a while. Every once in a while, someone
you just told me
yeah.
you hate me.
Yeah,
you know. And if you hate my music so much, then what do you care about how I conduct my business?
Right.
Anyway, I'm very happy about the way I've conducted this record.
Good.
Nobody's getting rich off this, especially me.
Right.
And the people who threw in the money, they wanted to.
Yeah, they want to hear it. They want to hear this record.
And I didn't.
I did not
beg and plead on my knees to people. I didn't, you know, I didn't put on commercials. I wasn't campaigning for president.
You didn't make a little film?
I did a little.
I didn't even watch it. Why didn't I see it?
Well,
that?
My film wasn't as good as Miles.
Miles is
oh my God,
fucking hysterical.
So amazing.
Yeah,
but mine was like, you know, just a sitting there in front of the board, play it. I played a half a song, and I said, well, this is what I want to do. You know, and I paid the guy like $300 for that. And,
you know? The thing is that the Kickstarter actually does start off a little economy because it helps money going back into the studios,
definitely.
Which are losing
it's
their
cool.
money. And some guy with that's an aspiring filmmaker gets a little scratch
and you know
for
what?
Doing something instead of like, hey,
letter.
Bro, I'll get you high if you do this thing. You know what I mean?
Well, there's a whole, in fact, that's been a little bit of the
oh,
way
yeah.
we get things.
Hey.
We've got a couple of, you know, different Stoner instruments dudes. That way. Yeah. Besides, some of the wiener gets, you know, more valuable than money. But it so cool. But I, you know, you better believe I got to pay taxes on that money.
Yeah.
And I just got an email from Amazon Kickstarter saying we need you to fill out this form. It's going to have to go to the IRS and yada yada yada. Yeah. And so, you know, and that's sobering.
Yeah.
You know, there's. The money's pretty much, you know,
spent.
Oh yeah, I got to come up with more money to do the mix and the packaging and promo, and we're gonna have to figure something out for all that.
Well, I bet you'll be able to do all that.
I think so too.
You're a resourceful gentleman.
I think so too. Things are looking up for Fastball as well.
Good. What's going on with that?
Well, we managed to sever ties finally with a long-going management situation, which took a lot of money out of our residuals every quarter.
Yeah.
And now that's gone, so we're, you know, we're free from that. We get that much more money.
A little more liquid.
We got finally released from EMI, our publishing company, that, you know.
So now you own.
They took 25% of our money.
So now you own.
But they never did anything, right? They never did. Now we got a guy who's taking a lot less,
and
who's
doing
something with it. So we're getting, it's fantastic to see, you know, even, it's really fantastic to see some of Miles' titles actually earning.
Yeah.
Fire Escape has earned this quarter, I think, more than the last 5 years combined, I think.
Wow.
I mean, because of these
placements and stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Man.
It's awesome.
Well, congratulations. And congratulations on being a dad for the fourth time.
Thank you. Thank you.
And your health, you look healthy.
Thanks.
You seem healthy.
I could, yeah.
You look very happy.
I try to get to the gym, but man.
Oh, no. It's tough. Well,
I think I just got that sympathetic husband thing.
Yeah.
With a pregnant wife, the husband's belly starts to.
I see that.
Yeah.
That happens. So, do you have any shows coming up that you want to plug, or anything you want to?
I would love to say I did, but I have zero shows booked right now. Speaking right now, I think the Tycoons have something in February.
Okay, so yeah, well, well, enjoy your time off from playing, and good luck finishing the record. Maybe we can have you back when you have the record out, or at least play some stuff from it.
I would love to. I will.
Yeah, my friend Tony Scalzo. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
All right, man, that was a great songwriter, Tony Scalzo. It's Fastball. I'd like to thank Tony for coming by, and hopefully we have some interesting shows coming up for you. That was episode 30. Episode 30, 30 down, 30 to go. Good luck out there Christmas shopping, getting ready for the holidays, whatever it is that you do. This next song I'm going to play by Fastball is actually called How Did I Get Here? Tony sent me a tweet or a Facebook thing a couple weeks ago saying, hey, you know, I have a song called How Did I Get Here? So this is it, How Did I Get Here by Fastball. Thank you for listening.
How did I get here? Lying in the sunshine. All I have is tears. Watch them as they fall. I'm wishing you were here. This was supposed to be a good time. This was supposed to be our year. Now there's nothing after all. How did I get here? I guess it doesn't really matter. I'll try and pass the day without you on my mind. Without you next to me, this is feeling like a bad dream. I'm doing it again. Thought about you one more time. I'm sending out a message via satellite. Where are you tonight, my dear? We're all missing you right here. We're lighting you a candle in the dead of night. Where are you tonight, my dear? We're all missing you. We'll be right back. I'm missing you right here. Lighting you a candle in the dead of night. Where are you tonight, my dear? We're all missing you. How did I get here? Lying in the sunshine. All I have is tears. Watch them as they fall. How did I get here? I guess it doesn't really matter. Try and pass the day without you on my mind. Without you next to me, this is feeling like a bad dream. There I'm doing it again. I thought about you one more time.